Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, we're going to try a new beer for this episode.
Mm-hmm.
It's from a very local brewery. It's probably our most local one yet. It's called Brawling Beer Brewing, and it's just up the road in Gaithersburg, Maryland. We record this podcast here in North Bethesda, Maryland, and if you just go a couple more exits north on I-270, you will run in to Gaithersburg, Maryland, and what is there is Brawling Bear Brewing. This is called The Fight. The Fight. And I think you would agree with me if I describe this as a coffee stout.
Okay, and so here I'm taking my first sip. It actually has hints of a chocolate smell, too.
Man, that's strong.
Wow. Yeah, it's a very dark beer for sure.
It looked like a... like oil when I was pouring it out of the
guy.
I got a 32-ounce growler of this. And it's a limited release. You can only get this in October.
Oh.
And it. I went on the website and it says dark chocolate and coffee with a smooth, dry finish.
It's, you know what? That's accurate. I absolutely agree with that. And so it's, I like chocolate. I like coffee. Mm. It's heavier than a beer that I would normally choose.
It's going to help me think.
You know, I only had you pour me like a tablespoon.
Yeah, you didn't go that heavy on that.
I went with the shot glass instead. But yeah, not too bad. But does it have anything to do with any of
the
films?
It does. I did connect. There's a reason we got this. There's a reason I got this because it's from Brawling Bear and it's called The Fight.
So it's something with fighting. And
focus more on Brawling Bear.
Brawling. Maybe, I don't know. Is it something with wildlife?
It is. It's wildlife. I'm connecting this to wildlife.
Okay.
No? You're not picking it up? No. Brawling Bear? No?
No. Wildlife Bear?
We're going to talk about a movie called Wildlife.
Which has nothing to do with wildlife,
and if you give me a list of animals, I'd be like, yeah. Yeah, a bear is wildlife.
Yes, but that film has absolutely nothing to do with wildlife. It's a double entendre, I believe, and you really don't hear a reference to.
You know what? Studio 54 doesn't have anything to do with Studio 54. That's not the 54th studio.
It was on 54th Street in New York. There was a 54.
It's not a studio.
Yes, it.
Anyways, you were very lucky this past weekend. I got to go to a wonderful wedding. Down in Clearwater Beach, I got to see my son be a ring bearer. There was Pat and Carrie got married, lovely couple. Perfect wedding. However, it fell on the same weekend as the best film festival in North America. The perfect location to shut yourself away and watch 4 to 5 movies a day. You got to go to the Middleburg Film Festival, just a fantastic, magical place to be, way over there in the foothills of the Shenandoahs in Virginia. Tell me about 2018's version of Middleburg Film Festival.
Well, that is very high praise that you feel like you missed the best film
festival
in all of North America.
I really do.
We haven't been to all that many to compare it to, but we do enjoy. I think this was my third year in a row. And it really is always a fun time. And it's not just about the slate of films that is pretty remarkable. You get your Oscar contenders and a lot of foreign films and documentaries and smaller sort of hidden gem kind of films. And it's impossible to actually map out how to see as many things as you need to see. I absolutely enjoyed myself. It was chillier than the past 2 years. So it was a little easier to be inside these venues. But I saw in the end, I think, 7 or 8 films. And I definitely saw what I am predicting now should be the Oscar winning film of the year.
Well, we said that last year when we saw three billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri at this Sunday morning's kind of centerpiece film screening, and the audience just lost their minds and stood up and clapped. Like, this is it. This is the film.
And it should have been. I stand by that choice last year.
Absolutely. It's my favorite film.
And the people that, the one that everyone stood up for and applauded for and that won the audience award at Middleburg Film Festival this year was a film called Green Book. And oh my gosh, it has everything. You laugh, you cry. It has Viggo Mortensen, who was there, by the way, along with director Peter Farrelly, was also there for a post-screening Q&A. And Mahershala Ali, who everyone will remember from Moonlight.
Won an Oscar for that.
Won an Oscar also that I had also seen at Middleburg. The two of them, it is their film, and it's a road trip drama of sorts with humor, and it's all about these two guys. Viggo Mortensen is sort of this white Italian-American street smart bouncer guy who ends up taking a job driving and protecting this genteel, proper, very highly educated black concert pianist who is about to embark on an 8-week concert tour through the Deep South in, I believe it was 1962 when the Jim Crow laws were in effect, very segregated. And so the Viggo Mortensen character basically has to not only drive the piano player, but also protect him. And so this is based on a true story. This is a very real friendship that came out of this experience. And it's your typical kind of both learn from each other kind of movie, and they both go into this journey with these sort of preconceived notions about race and society. But I'll tell you, man, you come out of this and you are just, everybody feels good. It's just one of those movies that has everything. And so Thanksgiving, Green Book, go see it, and hopefully it's going to be on everyone's list for Oscar nomination.
It's got the buzz. People are already talking about it, and I won't be surprised when it starts winning some awards. I'm looking forward to seeing it. You make it sound awesome.
It's awesome all around. And then,
so you did see. So Middleburg is contemporary. There are films that have already been released, and there are films being released today. In fact, that you saw mm-hmm. in Middleburg, you saw two of those. The first one is very interesting. I really wanted to see this one because I know Melissa McCarthy as kind of a pratfaller, as a mm-hmm. physical comedy. Person, Bridesmaids. We just saw her this year.
Spy, wasn't that one?
Spy. What did we just see her in?
That one about like the where her kids in college. Wasn't
oh, Life of the Party? No, but we saw something more recent than that.
Is there another one too? Oh, wait, there was another one. Was
it? I'll remember it. It was, yeah. It was just a couple weeks ago. But it looks like, and I don't watch trailers, so I have no idea, but it looks like Melissa McCarthy's in a drama.
It is a drama. She's
in a film called...
Oh, Can You Ever Forgive Me? But another one based on a true story about this writer named Lee Israel, who was a, I guess she was known for sort of celebrity biographies, was a best-selling author, but she fell on hard times. She couldn't get anything. Her agents, just played by Jane Curtin, by the way, is really not doing much of anything for her. And to make ends meet, she ends up forging these very witty letters from celebrities, from famous people, like just, you know, oh, my cousin found this in their attic and it's, you know, it was written by so-and-so back in 1962 and isn't it brilliant? And so people would buy these letters, these auctioneers and traders and memorabilia people. And eventually the law catches up with her. And so that's what this story is about, is sort of her... her attempts at sort of reclaiming some kind of way to still use her skills but also make money. And yes, Melissa McCarthy, it's a very toned down Melissa McCarthy. She's, you know, stripped of makeup for the most part. But she still has a very cynical wit that comes across even as she's playing in this dramatic role. I enjoyed the story because I really didn't know about it. And when you get these true stories that you're just kind of like, wow, that really happened and this person got busted, you know, then I like learning about them. But I found the film, it's getting very high praise, but I actually found it to be rather slow.
So I remembered the movie we saw her in, compare it to how we felt about the Happy Time Murders.
Oh, gosh, yeah. No, I would put this about 1,000 times above the Happy Time Murders. You know, again, that one, it was sort of campy. This is you know, it's a real person and a real story. And so that comes across. And then the best part of this film is this dynamic that she has with her. She has this sort of drinking buddy, a street hustler named Jack, played by Richard E. Grant. And the two of them kind of work together to keep her little scheme going a little longer when the FBI starts kind of getting wind of something amiss. Mm-hmm. And the two of them are just both very good. So the performances are very good. I see Melissa McCarthy in these dramatic roles sort of taking on that same twist and turn that like Steve Carell.
Yeah, he had one of those career shifts.
Yes.
Yeah. And like so it's, Foxcatcher.
Exactly. And, yeah. So it's a shift that she's showing that she can make that turn, that she can pull it off. And so really good performances, but it wasn't – to me, it was not a great movie. It's one of those ones that I felt like you really could wait and put it in your – rental queue and watch it on the small screen. I don't really feel like you need to go rush out and see it on the big screen.
And the second one you saw, that which also comes out today, looked awesome because I love Hilary Swank. I love Hilary Swank. Boys Don't Cry, Million Dollar Baby. I don't see her as often as I would like to in films, and she's in a film called What They Had, and the subject matter scares me.
Well, it's about family caregiving, really. It's about a daughter who goes back home when she finds out that her mom has sort of wandered off on Christmas Eve because she's got Alzheimer's. And it's about this family's effort to try and decide, you know, what do we do? Do we put her into a memory care facility, which is what her brother, played by Michael Shannon, who we also love. But then her father, Robert Forster, wants to keep her, played by Robert Forster, wants to keep her at home. And so it's such a relatable film, but the reason you haven't seen Hilary Swank lately and the reason she was drawn to this film is she took several years off to care for her father after a lung transplant. Hmm. So there was a reason. So this material spoke to her to sort of come back in and he's doing better and she's able to get back to work. And so the subject matter was very critical to her choice to come back and play this role. And it also has Blythe Danner plays the mom. So, I mean, incredible ensemble cast. And where a lot of people were afraid going into this film that they were about to see this really oppressive Still Alice kind of movie.
Oh, yeah.
This one has some really great lighthearted moments too. I mean, everyone can relate to whether it's the relationship between the brother and the sister, or between the sister and the father, or the brother and the father, and how the mom is just sort of peripherally there. I would say I don't think it's not driven by Blythe Danner's performance. It's really an ensemble performance, and Elizabeth Chomko. She's an actress who this is her first directing credit. And so she wrote and directed this film because her own grandmother had Alzheimer's and the family took care of her for 16 years. And so she kind of was inspired to write this film based on her own family's experiences. And so it's just a really solid film that luckily is not difficult to watch, but people came out of it really feeling like they could identify with this family and really enjoyed the movie. So it got a decent reception at Middleburg.
Man, something is scratching at the back of my memory here. Blythe Danner played a mother earlier this year with dementia, and her son kept having to come get her when she'd get accidentally shoplift something from the store. And I can't remember what it is.
Really?
And like, it was one of those movies where he's got like 17,000 things going on and his mother's just one of them. And he's like having woman trouble or whatever it is. And I just can't. That's going to drive me nuts until
we'll
I figure that out.
I'll have to look it up. But yeah, I must have missed that one. But again, just a really solid movie, and you couldn't ask for a better cast. And Hilary Swank, it's nice to see her back.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's just good material.
All right. Our next film actually played, I believe, at Middleburg. You didn't see it, but we both got to watch it at our respective homes, and it's called Wildlife. Now I can play, because I saw this first, and yes. I was like, Hannah, you have to watch it just because of who the director is. But also, it made me so mad.
I was reading your tweets and going, I think I'm going to have to watch this film just to sort of be able to keep up with why you were so upset.
Well, I'm going to see if you got mad at all either. We're talking about a movie called Wildlife. And while I'm interested in the directors, because we've recently, this year I think has been particularly heavy, actors turned first time directors. Mm-hmm. In the past few weeks, I think we've had a number of them, but I naturally...
Well, including Elizabeth Chomko with What They Had.
And so this is directed by Paul Dano. You remember Paul Dano from Little Miss Sunshine, mm-hmm. from There Will Be Blood, from 12 Years a Slave, from Swiss Army Man. We know Paul Dano. He's awesome. So he had read this novel, this particular Richard Ford novel, published in 1990. He said a number of times and just really connected with it. And finally got a chance to make this family drama.
Is that what it's
film.
Called?
And it's, I think, yes, this is one genre, family drama. And there's mom, dad, and boy. Dad is Jake Gyllenhaal, mm-hmm. Jerry. Jerry is kind of a functioning alcoholic, gets fired from his golf pro job in rural Montana, where they just moved. And, his reasoning is, everyone likes me too much. I'm just too well-liked. He's that kind of guy.
Yeah.
And then he disappears from most of the movie to go fight a wildfire that's burning nearby. He doesn't know how to fight fires. They just need men, and he goes. And his wife, Jeanette, played by Carey Mulligan, an awesome Carey Mulligan, mm-hmm. does not want him to go. Do not leave us behind. You're abandoning your family. You're going to die. Please don't go. So when he leaves, Jeanette spirals out of control. There's no money coming in. They're going to lose their house. She doesn't know what to do. She doesn't have a steady job. So she starts cozying up to the local town gentleman. In rural Montana in 1960, the big well-to-do guy is the guy who owns the car dealership. And it's played by Bill Camp. His name's Warren Miller. He's a character actor you'll recognize. You know, it's one of those guys you see, where do I know him from?
Right,
you've seen him in like 27 movies.
Mm-hmm.
That was Bill Camp. And they kind of begin this low-grade adulterous affair, and watching it all, and we're watching it through the eyes of the son, 14-year-old Joe. He's played by Ed Oxenbold, and I remembered him immediately from Alexander and the No Good Terrible Whatever Bad Day. And he's grown up a lot. He's officially hit puberty,
and he was in The Visit, which I never
remember. Seen. The Visit was awesome. Yeah, he was great in that. And Jeanette starts doing everything a parent should not do. She just kind of gives up. They're no longer mother and son. They're just kind of like really good acquaintances. They have the conversations that you don't want to have with your mother. She takes him to dinner at Warren's house, and that just crosses too many lines.
That dinner scene, I was ready to just give up.
Remember how long the dinner scene in August, Osage County was?
Oh, yeah. Too long.
it's like that infamous 19-minute scene. This felt like one of those infamous 19-minute scenes. I wanted to die while I was watching this scene. And that scene is what really made me so mad.
It did, because it just, here you have this kid, Joe. He's 14 years old, and suddenly he's the adult in the family. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He's the most stable. He's gotten himself an after-school job at a photography studio.
He cooks dinner.
I mean, he's just stable and normal. And here he's having to watch his parents' marriage disintegrate. He's having to watch his mother flirt and then do more with this Mr. Miller guy. And it's just, it's horrifying to watch. And you hate his mother more and more as
really
every minute ticks by, because she's being so irresponsible. And I mean, who tells their kid, like, I just wish I would die? I mean, she says that to him at one point. And it's just, you just feel terrible, because basically both parents have abandoned this kid.
Yeah.
One to go fight a wildfire, even though he has no firefighting skills whatsoever. And the other, the mom, just because she's just so bitter and mad because she was like June Cleaver before.
She really was, yeah.
You know, before the before her husband took off. And then she just makes this, you know, huge turn and becomes just a bad person.
Well, I want to say, like, of course, parents are real people too. We all know that. Plenty of films have said, you know, you don't need to idealize mom and dad. They're real people too. They have flaws like everybody else. But not all of them encourage their son to join in adultery with them. And life is hard. And 34, which Jeanette makes a point of saying she's 34, she's not what she thought she would be when she was 34. You know what? Tough.
Yeah, too bad.
Tough. There's no
You're
reason to turn yourself into a miserable parent and start escorting out of your house.
Well, so I mean, it's not that extreme.
I was just about to yell at the screen, pull your head out of your... Jeanette.
I mean, I just, to me, this is a bleak film to watch. And I'll tell you, I mean, Jake Gyllenhaal and Carey Mulligan, they are both actors. They love to immerse themselves into very complex characters. And they do that here. I mean, Jake Gyllenhaal is a much smaller role because basically since we're seeing this whole thing through the 14-year-old's eyes, when dad is off fighting fires, he is off. He's not in the picture, literally. And so, you know, so you're not really getting all that much of Jake Gyllenhaal, just sort of bookending this film. So it's really Carey Mulligan's performance and as well as Ed Oxenbold. I would actually think that this performance is one, even though I did not particularly like this movie at all, I do think the performances were good, and I can see putting Ed Oxenbold like on that list that we maintain of young actors' performances for like the WAFCA Youth Performance Award, because he's like 17 now.
Yeah, he's great.
And so he's very good, so he's one to watch. But this is rated PG-13, and I can't think of any teenager, let alone an adult, that would really necessarily want to see this. But it certainly has very adult themes. And so I'm actually bothered for all the things that we see that are rated R for no reason. Mm. This is a PG-13 that I think actually would have been better off rating R.
Well, it's gorgeous. I mean, it really is gorgeous. They have these long like crane shots watching Joe kind of interact in this small town. And it's actually not Montana. It's Oklahoma. And Paul Dano adapted the screenplay with his real-life partner, Zoe Kazan. And we just saw Zoe Kazan last year in that billion-dollar rom-com, The Big Sick, with Camille Nanjiani. You know, that's her. So I didn't read the novel, and I never will, because I want to stay far away from the story. However, we're in the minority.
Like I know.
96% on the tomato meter.
I want to know what the audience score is on this one, because I'll tell you, and sort of flashing back to Middleburg for a second, because one of the other big films that was considered brilliant that everyone was looking forward to seeing was a film called Roma. It had such a divisive thing. It's a critical darling. But I can tell you, at least 5 people walked out.
Ooh, hey.
And then people talking afterwards, there were an awful lot of people at the screening who just did not like it at all. And so I just feel like, especially at award season, you end up with this divide. There are a lot of people who really did not like Shape of Water, which won the Oscar last year. And yet it was kind of the front runner to win because it had such critical acclaim. This is one of those ones that it has the critical acclaim for its performances.
Specifically, Carey Mulligan.
Carey Mulligan.
Crazy raves.
Sure, because she really is a very complex character here, and you're watching her go through this change. So even though you don't like her at all very quickly in this film, you can't deny that she's playing this irresponsible, unlikable woman very well. So I can see why Carey Mulligan would get the nod, but overall, this is just not an entertaining film.
All right, our next two films are both documentaries, and the first one I remember played at AFI Docs earlier this year. I didn't see it there. I didn't see it until this week, and it's called The Price of Everything. And I remember this was Christian Hammacher's number one AFI Docs documentary, and that's actually very high praise. If Christian says you're number one, then that's worth taking notice of. The Price is Everything is about the relationship between art and money, specifically contemporary art, modern art, that kind of art you look at and be like, not only do I think my kid can paint this, someone tells me this is worth $50 million. And it's kind of a peek behind the curtain at that world. The artists themselves, the dealers, the buyers, the auction houses, they're all in. I'm going to say they're all in on it, because actually they all are internal stakeholders in keeping these prices obscenely high. And yeah, some of the art is very interesting, and they have a gift. You know, certain art dealers have a gift at describing this art in this flowery prose and adjectives that, oh, I never thought about that before. I guess I can see that for $10 million. But so it's directed by a name named Nathaniel Kahn. He was nominated for an Oscar way back in 2003 for a documentary called My Architect. I remember hearing about it, never saw it. I felt dirty after The Price of Everything. I felt queasy. Like, there's a lot of, I didn't realize the art market, the art world, but I guess it's like any other business. There's a lot of snake oil salesmen involved. And some of the art, like the artists, like Jerry Koons is apparently he's the most financially successful artist alive right now. But he doesn't do his works. He doesn't paint. He runs a factory. He hires painters to paint his paintings for him, because he says, what if I only produced two a year? I'd be depriving the world of Jerry Koons. I'm like, oh, way to go, dude. And then there's Marilyn Minter, who sells million-dollar paintings, painting blurry pubic hair, which I guess is awesome. And then you look at a guy who used to be hot, painting dots, and now he's not anymore, Larry Poons. He fell out of favor because maybe he wasn't playing the game. And the central arc here, we revisit about every 10 minutes or so, is the Sotheby's auction, the Sotheby's fall auction, which is supposed to rake in just an obscene amount of money. And we follow one of their main, I don't know, I call her a hype woman, Amy Capilazzo. And one of the guys, Gerhard Richter, a lot of his paintings are being sold or put up for auction. He's not going to make any money. Someone already bought him. You know, if his painting sells for $10 million, he doesn't see any of that. That's whoever bought it earlier on gets all that money. And he says, I would like to see my paintings go to a museum. And she looks horrified. Why would you do that? Then you'd be depriving blah blah blah, and they could just put it in storage. And like, you're sleazy. You're just sleazy. And then they find these other buyers that are like the Real Housewives of New York. They're like, oh, everybody has conceptual art right now, and it's this really garish looking table. And I'm glad I learned about it. I'm glad I know about it now, because now if it had a facade, if it had a veneer, it's gone. They're just in any other huckster game. It appeals it. And this was not a hit job. Nathaniel Kahn did not go in there saying, I'm going to pull back the curtain and show you for fraud you are. They're not. If someone says this is worth $10 million, then it is, right? Yeah. They'll pay you money.
If somebody's willing
is.
To pay it, then it is.
And, your investment banker is saying you need this in your diversified portfolio because you can sell it in 20 years for a markup. But there's something wrong here.
That's why I like the whole Banksy thing with the painting that sold at auction then automatically shredded itself.
And now it's worth more.
But I did not see this one at AFI Docs. It just didn't hold all that much appeal to me. And it was one of those festivals, again, where you're just having to pick and choose. And I'd already seen, I think, literally a dozen movies in the past week. And so there was just no way to fit this one in. I'm just not always in line with Christian in terms of...
This was not a bad film. I mean, it's not at all.
Oh, right. But he loved that Hampton Fancher escape documentary. So, I just never know for sure.
But Christian agreed with us when we watched Shirkers together really late that night.
Yeah.
About the Singapore thing.
No, so every once in a while, for sure, we might agree. But this is just... It does not appeal to me to the point where I feel like I would go back and try and catch it at any point. So again, I guess you can put it in that list of documentaries that teach you something new, but don't necessarily.
And I might be in the minority here. I didn't hear too many other critics saying, I felt, oily after this film. They didn't take it as harsh as I did. Cause it can be funny, seeing all these quirky people. But I don't know. I just lost some love for the art market.
I don't know. I think sometimes you take some of these things a little too seriously, Charlie.
Well, one film I did not take seriously was Studio 54. And I'll tell you immediately why this is not a movie for me. I'm too young. And
I feel I'm
just too young. And I feel if you were not, if you didn't have conscious thought from 1977 to 1980 and weren't aware of really what Studio 54 did, not only to New York City, but to celebrity culture. You know, I've heard of Studio 54. Everybody's heard of it. Mm-hmm. I believe there was a miserable 1998 movie starring Mike Myers about it. But Studio 54, I have no idea. Like, I have no idea what it did to America. Ian Schrager and Steve Rebell apparently pulled off a coup and shot themselves into the stars by just creating a place for celebrities to hang out and do debaucherous things.
Well, but that's what the documentary does, is it sets the context for how and why Studio 54 exploded in the 70s when it did. The most fascinating thing to me was that this place only was open for 33 months.
Yeah, for this must have been open for 19 years.
Yeah, it's legendary. It wasn't. You think it's something that's just been a staple, and maybe just kind of faded into obscurity as times changed. But no, they got caught up in a whole tax evasion scheme and money laundering stuff and
keep the cash in the ceiling, keep the quaaludes in the safe,
drugs, you know, and so they ended up going to prison for a couple of years, and then you know, so then they had to sell the club off, and then it just basically died. And so I didn't realize that. I mean, it was kind of very interesting to just sort of explore the cultural significance that the place had for this relatively brief time, where it was a free love environment and this mix of beauty and bizarre.
And this will only really work, though, for people of a certain age.
It will. And the whole velvet, the introduction of the whole velvet rope line idea. But like Artie Chick reviewed it for Chick Flicks because she actually lived in New York, you know, around that time or soon afterwards, and is older and has those memories of knowing about Studio 54. For me, you know, any reference to disco and all that would be like from Saturday Night Fever. And there's a little hint of...
Well, they say John Travolta wouldn't have gotten in that club.
He might
probably... You can't wear polyester into Studio 54.
Yes, he could not wear polyester. But it's a decent doc for anyone of that era who's interested in the subject matter. But I agree that if you're younger and if you just kind of go Studio 54, no interest whatsoever, then this is not the doc you.
But I learned things. Like Studio 54 accepted and even encouraged gay culture in a city in a time that did not. I learned there was a roll arena and a disco Sally. I love them. And a fascinating, fascinating interview with Michael Jackson.
Yeah, when you see the young Michael Jackson in there.
I think the reporter was Jane Pauley. Mm-hmm. Oh,
was
my
Jane
gosh.
Pauley. So, yeah, I mean, this place was hot. You know, it was the place to see and be seen and to get into, and there was this true status involved with going in. But the people who were in there, they were like a family. They considered themselves family, and they could... Basically, everybody danced with everybody else, and it was this incredible venue for them. But it's also what precipitated the downfalls, because nobody gets angrier than those who aren't allowed in, and that sense of privilege and the haves and the have-nots. And so, you know, it's people who couldn't get through the line that probably started to really push government officials to really investigate what was going on with this club. So, you know, there's a double-edged sword to the popularity and to being selective in the way that they were.
You know, I noticed something. So this is directed by Matt Tiernauer. We've talked about him before on this podcast. He did Citizen Jane.
Oh, right.
The lady who prevented mm-hmm. a freeway from cutting Manhattan Island in half. There are no interviews with celebrities who were there. Not one.
What do you mean? You just sort of see there.
You always see. You
see pictures.
Standard
you see
documentaries.
Footage.
You get. Oh, I remember going to Studio 54. There's no. You get pictures. You get photo albums. He didn't get. I don't know Warren Beatty he didn't get anybody.
The interviews are with the people that
with the workers. You got the bartender and the bouncer.
Yeah, but that's and that's the biggest flaw of this
film. He didn't
get
Liza, and apparently she was there every night.
She was there all the time. But that's why they were sort of relying on sort of bringing you back into that time period. But I do think there was a problem. This is sort of a tale of two halves. This film, the documentary, starts with such high energy.
Yeah, big time.
Brings you into the club. It's kind of cool. The music's playing.
Great soundtrack.
Great soundtrack. And then about halfway through, it shifts to the legal woes and to the downfall.
Roy Cohn.
And Roy Cohn being their lawyer. And you're just like, eh. And it just kind of start the pacing just completely
slows
down.
It fell off a cliff. Absolutely.
It fell off a cliff. So I really enjoyed the first half. This was way too long. I remember thinking that, you know, this film should not be more than 80 minutes, like turn it into one of those perfectly timed 80-minute documentaries. It was over an hour and a half, and I felt every extra minute of that. And so when you go from such high energy to zero energy, that to me was a problem. So again, you know, it's not going to knock anything off of a list of top documentaries of the year. It's just another one of those ones that, you know, hey, if you remember Studio 54, you were in the disco scene, you went dancing in the clubs every night, you wondered whatever happened to that place, then go ahead and watch this one when you can watch it on Netflix.
Well, today it's a Broadway theater, and I was wondering, you know, you go up there like a couple times a year, and I was wondering if you'd seen a show there.
I'm not sure which theater it became, but I'll have to, next time I'm in New York, I will actually sort of seek that out to kind of go, I know all about the history now of Studio 54.
Well, a quick tease for next week is the biggest film for next week, which we've already seen, and a lot of people are already talking about, is Bohemian Rhapsody, about the life and times of Queen, and specifically the lead Queen, Freddie Mercury, and Rami Malek's portrayal of him. And I won't give anything away yet, but we've
seen it.
But we will tell you about it next week.
And I'll just note that one thing we did miss that is out there this week for those who love a good submarine thriller, hunter killer.
Who doesn't love a good submarine thriller?
Who doesn't, you know, a total escapist fare from what I'm hearing, but it's with Gerard Butler, and he plays sort of the submarine captain. It's, you know, one of those high-stakes Russian involvement movies. And I actually heard folks talk about how they kind of enjoyed it, that it was entertaining. It was preposterous, but entertaining. And sometimes those movies you just, you need when you're surrounded by a whole bunch of heavy stuff.
Yeah, I would have loved to have seen Hunter Killer right after Wildlife.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking, is that when you see some of these other bleak films, it just makes you want one of those big escapist flicks with Gerard Butler. So we missed that one, but we did see Bohemian Rhapsody, and can't see everything, right, Charlie?
My body won't let me. All right, quick recap. We started with, not only did we start with Brawling Bear Brewing, which you've drank more than I thought you would.
I know, I'm finishing it off.
We started with the Middleburg Film Festival, specifically the two films being released this week. The first one being Can You Ever Forgive Me?
With Melissa McCarthy, which is okay, but I think it's fine to save for a rental.
And What They Had.
If you can relate to a family caregiving story and trying to figure out what to do with a beloved family member who has dementia, then you'll really be able to relate to this film, and it's not too sad.
Wildlife gets high marks for just being gorgeous to look at and some really chew-the-scene acting, but man, you gotta want it.
Great acting. I did not want it.
The Price of Everything, I think, is the best documentary we talked about, just because it's about a world you don't know about. And you know what? It's an interesting subject. It really is.
So it's the best documentary that you saw this week, because I didn't see it.
I'm guessing that you would have liked it better.
So I suspect I probably would not have liked it any worse than Studio 54, which, if you are a person of the 70s, era, then that's really who it's for, and that's about it. But I don't think I'll catch up on Price of Everything, but I also don't expect people to go run out and find Studio 54.
All right, outstanding. And thanks once again to Brawling Bear Brewing from Gaithersburg, Maryland. On behalf of the Cinema Clash, I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah. is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.